Chapter 3. Casablanca Christmas. Christmas is here, and there's no room at the inn. My parents' River Heights Terrace home is a two-bedroom apartment. There are guest accommodations down the hall, but we were too slow to book, and I have to find temporary quarters for the holidays. Christmas iconography may suggest that I should bunk in a stable. I think I came pretty close. There's no manger here, but it's mangy. My lodging is a motel, located about half a mile down the road. When I was young, it was called the Starlight. Under new management, it is now known as the Casablanca. The architecture betrays no Moroccan influences. There's no restaurant or room service, which rules out tangy lamb tagine with couscous. If Humphrey Bogart ever passed through Brandon, he kept it quiet. The motel's not even white. Why is it called the Casablanca? Why is North Korea called the Democratic People's Republic? Why is New Jersey the Garden State? In 1965, when the Burgess family arrived in Brandon, the Starlight Motel was already a relic, a victim of urban development. Its location on Victoria Avenue made perfect sense back when Victoria doubled as part of the Trans-Canada Highway, and the Starlight was the first option for weary Studebaker pilots headed east. Then the highway moved north, bypassing the expanding town that quickly swallowed up and digested the Starlight. Now, like a beached ship, the old motel sits in a primarily residential zone and has been rechristened the Casablanca. It's unlikely a bottle of champagne was wasted. Even when I was a kid, it seemed incongruous. Who would stay there? Trysting townies? Their cars would be easy enough to spot. For many years, it was a couple of blocks away from the now-defunct Suburban Restaurant, the city's finest, in an era when Baked Alaska was sophistication incarnate, and a name that invoked the suburbs apparently held some sort of cachet. As such, it may have been a destination for tipsy celebrants playing it safe. Except in those days, nearly everybody on the road was half-drunk and thought little of it. So I don't know how it survived. Maybe it was waiting for me. Maybe I used to be the caretaker. I always loved The Shining. As I drive up to the office, it is clear I have one thing in common with Jack Nicholson at the Overlook Hotel. I'm going to be the only resident. It's snowing, too. A short woman in cleaning togs hustles down the long sidewalk and enters the office. "Sorry," she says, "I just had to fire the cleaning woman. I'm Barb. My husband Ralph and I just took over managing the place, just got here from Alberta." As I fill out the form, she elaborates. "The previous manager was scamming the owner," she says, "skimming off the top. Plus, he'd take a security deposit from a customer and then throw them out, tell them there was no drinking or something, and pocket the deposit. One old guy used to bring his native gal here every week. He threw them out and kept their money. He's never been back." Some places could fall back on the carriage trade, but the Casablanca needs its regulars. If the name change was intended to goose business, it wasn't working. No vehicles were parked along the long row of rooms. Casablanca's Rick was plagued by Nazis. The Shining's Jack Torrance by madness. I am suffering a serious attack of lower back pain. "A firm mattress?" I ask hopefully. "We're replacing them gradually," Barb says. "Last week there was a party, and I guess there was a fight. One guy got hurt pretty bad, and the mattress was totally blood-soaked. So we had to replace that one." I cross my fingers for that room. I get 116, down at the end of the deserted row, a small, dowdy, but clean cubicle, offering vintage carpet, wood paneling, fridge, microwave, TV, dead batteries in the largest remote I've ever seen, and a surprisingly good mattress. The calendar reads November. A framed quotation on the wall is taken from John 3:16, and not, as I expected, "all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy." The bathroom sink is an unpredictable beast, pooling up for long periods and then suddenly draining on a whim. But there are no visible vermin. Happily, it is much too cold outside for any crawly new arrivals. That offers one small advantage over my old bedroom in the family basement, which had been Palm Beach for wintering spiders. On the way to my parents' new home, I drive past our former digs. The driveway at 54 Clement Drive is now home to two cars, a pickup truck, and a basketball hoop. Someone is busy making new traditions in the old place. Well, good for them. I have my very own chateau. I am an Eastern potentate, a journeying king of the Orient. I am Lord of the Casablanca. None of the Burgess kids was prepared to embrace River Heights. A new family address is like a new stepmom after a quickie divorce. This one came with a whole new family. River Heights Terrace is an assisted living facility, not a nursing home, but serviced apartments for seniors with meals served in a communal dining room. What the food lacks in spice, it makes up with an exciting hint of international air travel. Food is not an issue for Mum these days. She's lucky in that, at least. And yet, with the new state of affairs, even the cherished Christmas dinner is out, unless it can be pulverized and pumped through a tube. We all recoiled at the feeding tube idea initially. Considered out of context, it almost seemed too much. Circumstances alter cases, as legal beagles say. Mum had actually been drinking Ensure meal replacement for years on account of her lifelong swallowing problems. The complicating factor of Parkinson's had only made the situation more grave. Still, her low weight was somewhat deceptive. For Mum, weighing less than an NFL lineman's leg is not the issue it might be for someone else. The kind of weight problem Mum has battled all her life is not the one that made Kirstie Alley famous. 80 pounds is only 20 or 30 below Mum's normal. And now, thanks to the magic sci-fi feeding tube, she's back up to 90. It has been a success. When the time comes, you do what's needed, and you have the Christmas you can manage. It's the old frog in a boiling pot story. Increase the heat gradually, and the frog never notices until he looks down and sees a French chef putting sauce on his legs. So it has been with Mum. Change has been incremental. And yet when you look back only a couple of short years, the transformation has been startling. Activities, abilities, key character traits have fallen away. Mum is still there, but her light shines fitfully, like a partly cloudy day. Still, we're doing okay in our new Bethlehem. Some of the surprise element has leaked out of the whole Christmas Eve thing. Mum has asked me to take her down to Staples and point out a couple of items I might find useful, then briefly leave the store while she buys one. It's not a bad system. One day I express a liking for a fleece blanket in Dad's room, only to find it wrapped up and under the tree on Christmas Eve. Somehow, that one gets me right in the tear ducts. Real gift of the Magi stuff. We celebrate the 57th anniversary with dinner out. Mum can at least order soup. All in all, a lovely evening, if perhaps tiring for some. On the way home, I am driving, with Mum in the passenger seat and Dad in the back. Conversation turns to the topic of a vintage coat. Apparently it went missing in the move. "I think I gave it away," Mum says. "I gave it to..." "Olivia," Dad chimes in. Olivia is their grandchild, Lynn's teenage daughter. "No," Mum says. "I know her." "Your home care nurse," I suggest. "No," Mum says, struggling. "Olivia's mother." I freeze like a man who has just heard terrible news. The radio is playing, and I hope Dad has been unable to hear our last exchange. "You mean Lynn?" I ask. "Yes," she says. We are silent for a moment. "I know the name," Mum says at last. "I can see the letters in my mind, but I just can't say them." It's not Alzheimer's. Whatever is going on inside her brain seems more comparable to faulty wiring or broken connections. She's not forgotten the information, and yet somehow she cannot retrieve it. "My world keeps getting smaller," she tells me one afternoon. It's undeniable. Her days are being gradually reduced to a country two-step: bed, feeding chair, back to bed. There's no return on this road, and she knows it. Even her ability to grasp those small pleasures left to her is deteriorating. And yet, not long ago, she told Lynn, there will never be enough time. Hypothetical discussions are just that, brave speculation about how you'll never put up with this or that indignity evaporates, and here you are in the present, hanging on. We want Mom to hang on, and she seems willing. My mother is a very tough bird. Nobody's quitting yet. But then, no one in this world has it easy. Certainly not the new managers of the Casablanca. On my very first night, I lose my key. It's after midnight, and I'm forced to trudge down to the office and rouse Rick and Barb out of bed, stammering apologies. At least it wasn't a knife fight. All in all, the week has been okay. Christmas holiday at the Casablanca is still a hometown Christmas. A long shuffle down the River Heights Terrace hallway is still a walk with my mother. The family home is gone. The family, as yet, is not. The old realities are sliding away, but that's a situation many grieving people wish they could have experienced. Some people's worlds end in a cataclysm, with sudden shocks and unbearable changes of circumstance. My family's world is adrift. A difficult transition, to be sure, but perhaps a kinder one. There are worse things than Christmas Eve at the Casablanca, watching It's a Wonderful Life. Although the way our familiar old world is crumbling away, perhaps the flick should be Gone with the Wind. March 2009. I'm on night shift again in the palliative care ward, watching TV and holding Mum's hand, listening to her gulping breath. Mum's last words have been spoken. We've had all we're going to get. And already I'm surprised and frustrated by the difficulty I have remembering things she said. Mum was not the sort of joker who regaled a table with knee-slapping anecdotes, but not because she lacked a sense of humor. When comfortably among family and friends, Mum was more of a quiet quipper, taking pleasure in dryly witty banter, but not for her the big joke. Jokes are little performances, and Mum loathed being the center of attention. Still, her counter-punching ability could always surprise, as it did one day while lunching with co-workers at the Assiniboine Community College. One of them was rambling on about animal husbandry. "If a castrated stallion is a gelding," he mused, "and a castrated ox is a steer, what would you call a castrated boar?" "A bigger boar," Mum blurted out. Mum and I loved to banter. Not the nasty one-upsmanship so beloved of frat boys, but just a gentle back-and-forth quipping. On those occasions when I might have been teasing her about something, she would always go along with the theme rather than jab back. Personal attacks, even gentle ones, were not her style. I know we both enjoyed it, without ever saying so. And now, I can recall almost none of the words, nothing specific. The things I remember her telling me are so random as to be exasperating. I remember Mum explaining to me the causes of toilet bowl grit, minerals in the water. I remember her teaching me to iron the sleeves and collar of a shirt first. But those beloved bantering sessions have already blurred, leaving behind just the outline of a sharp eye, a keen intelligence, and an animating spirit. I knew my mother pretty well. Never completely, of course. I wasn't there when the shaping events took place. But I did meet the principal shaper. Her name was Joan, too, sometimes called Annie. Annie Slorence was my grandmother. Whatever you might say about Grandma, she was influential, like gravity on meteors or meteors on dinosaurs. Grandma made a difference. The story of my mother's life is largely the story of her relationship with her own mother. The influence was direct at first, but almost as important later. It is a story of struggle, one that my mother almost didn't survive. Why are some destroyed by flames, while others are tempered? My mother's grim determination in the face of increasing paralysis has been further proof of something her children already knew. Her character is of steel. Perhaps that's only natural. Grandma was a blast furnace. Chapter 4. Grandma. Until I was 12, Grandma and Grandpa were a package deal. They visited together. We never saw them apart. They seemed a single entity, like the Beatles. Then came 1971. The Beatles were long gone. In the very early hours of May 6th, we kids were shaken awake and told to get dressed. Jock Slorence, our grandfather, had died of a heart attack. It had not been his first. Perhaps it was an occupational hazard of his chosen trade as a baker, but the cigars couldn't have helped either. Nor did Grandma's habit of making coleslaw with whipping cream. He was 72, although his gravestone wouldn't say so. Grandma fudged the dates to hide the terrible fact that she'd been a year older than her husband. As the car was being packed, Lynn wandered down the street, looking up at the stars, angry that the heavens held no sign of the change. I was just sleepy and bewildered, trying to balance the solemnity of the occasion with the excitement of a sudden, starlit journey. We bundled into the Oldsmobile for the long drive to Edmonton. It was my mother's 45th birthday. At the funeral, a piper played, and a kilted man sang Loch Lomond. It was my first real experience with death. I don't recall coming to any particular conclusions about it. We kids loved our grandparents. Or so I had thought. In subsequent years, I realized what we had all loved about Grandma and Grandpa. It was Grandpa. The two of them had always squabbled, but only in retrospect did I understand the situation well enough to take sides. Grandma, I now understood more clearly, was a giant pain. I probably picked up on some of this earlier, but when you're still in single digits, you don't tend to analyze things that have simply always been. Grandma and Grandpa had always been there and always honking at each other like a couple of geese in a territorial dispute. Grandpa was kindly and indulgent with his grandchildren. I loved to watch him shave as he took the implements from a leather kit, whipped up some shaving cream, floated it on the sink water, and slapped it on with an old shaving brush, and scraped off the whiskers with a straight razor. He was happy for the audience. He was different with his wife, prickly and perpetually exasperated, huffing like a steam press. "Mother," he would growl to halt some ongoing monologue. Early in my parents' marriage, my father took a train trip with Grandpa through Saskatchewan. Somewhere a few scotches along the flat, featureless route, the older man spoke of his daughter's good fortune. "I see you and Joan," he said. "It's wonderful the way you are together. You love each other. You talk." By contrast, the toxicity of our grandparents' relationship could be frightening. "She was extremely hard on Pop," said my Aunt Margaret, the youngest of their three children. "She imposed her will on him." The poison ran both ways. Margaret recalls an argument when her father slapped her mother hard. Christmas 1969 was our last altogether. The highlight was a gift Grandpa received from our cousins. Uncle Stan's three children got him a big trophy, the kind that might be handed out after a high school basketball tournament, with a little plaque inscribed, "World's Greatest Grandpa." It was just corny enough to qualify as the best grandpa gift ever. He was completely tickled. Lynn recalls another gift Grandpa got that Christmas, a pair of socks Grandma had knitted by herself. Grandpa's reaction made Lynn wince. He opened up the box, looked at the socks, and tossed them aside like a football. Grandma wasn't trying to make him miserable. She was just who she was. She couldn't really do anything about it. But he could be quite cruel to her. Grandma was who she was, all right. I could have been full of sympathy and understanding had she never come to visit. Medusa was not born with viper hair. According to the most popular version of the Gorgon legend, she was once a fair maiden of many gifts, only later to be transformed into a monster by jealous Athena. And Grandma? We were assured that she had once been young. A formidable lass, too. Mum made sure we heard of her youthful accomplishments when her skill and determination helped rescue her family from poverty back in Scotland. Certainly there was no denying the primal force of the woman. She was will incarnate. You only had to watch her play bridge. It wasn't hard to believe that she'd found ways to use her strength in an era when a young woman's options were limited. But that was ancient mythology to us. The woman we knew was obstinate, willful, capricious, manipulative, and as thoroughly self-involved as a high school prom queen. Joan Annie Barron was born near the border town of Hoek in 1897, one of nine children of Jasper Barron. An estate manager, he lost his position for daring to tell the lord of the manor how his affairs ought to be run. The family was reduced to dirt floor poverty, not helped by the patriarch's drinking. But if the national beverage had contributed to their domestic predicament, young Annie saw a way out via the national game. She became a scratch golfer. It was a skill she used to form useful social connections, which she then exploited to find new work for her father. Annie's childhood sweetheart was Jock Slorence of Hoek. No one among their children or grandchildren seems to have ever heard a specific story of how they met. Perhaps they had simply always been aware of each other. Or perhaps by the time there was an audience for the story, it was no longer one they felt the urge to tell. We heard some non-domestic war stories, though. Jock fought in the Great War, and survived that mechanized plague thanks only to a momentary intrusion of humanity. Buried up to the neck by a shell blast in 1918, Slorence came to, staring down the barrel of a German rifle. It would have been fairly standard practice at the time for that anonymous soldier to interrupt this delightful family story before it had even begun. But young Slorence was spared. His rewards were dubious. A POW camp, followed by near starvation during a post-war trudge across Germany to Holland, followed by Annie Barron. Jock Slorence immigrated to Canada. He worked on the Welland Canal and as a cook at a Muskoka Lake Resort hotel, where he made batches of pancake batter so large he had to stir them with an oar. Annie joined him, and the couple married in 1923 in Leduc, Alberta. The marriage would last 48 years. There were three children: Stan, born in 1924, Joan, in 1926, and Margaret, in 1927. Eventually, they would live to see 12 grandchildren, a narrow plurality of whom would bear the Burgess brand. Some of the Burgess kids share a weird little trait. It's a little hard to describe. Basically, we have a strong aversion to the sight of bumps. As kids, we'd be watching cartoons and some cat or kangaroo would get hit with a bat a couple of times, and we'd shriek! Not because of the violence. It was the little cartoon bumps that popped up on the victim's head. They creeped us out. Near the family cottage at Clear Lake, there was a little grove of trees afflicted with a disease that caused the leaves to erupt with bumpy growths. We would stroll through the trees, picking off leaves and compulsively squishing the bumps. Leslie had it worst. It was possible for the other kids to drive her crazy simply by repeating, "a cluster of bumps," a phrase that naturally became very popular. One day, Mum admitted that she had grown up with the same odd aversion. "But I was careful never to show it," she insisted. And really, it wouldn't have been hard to hide. Mum wasn't watching cartoons with us and shrieking along. It makes for a fascinating case study of nature versus nurture. Scientific studies of identical twins constantly attempt to discern which traits are inborn and which are learned. If a lab rat may be allowed an opinion about his own experience, I'd argue this shared revulsion, which we called bump torture, is unlikely to be learned behavior. I think it is in our genes. That was surely a disconcerting idea for Mum. The realization that a parent's best efforts cannot prevent certain genetic legacies from being passed along must have led to a few nights staring holes in the bedroom ceiling, because that was Mum's prime directive all along: to break the chain, to be better than her teacher, to control the inheritance she bequeathed to her children. Our childhoods, she determined, would differ from hers, and she would be a different mother from her own. Not that she announced this goal every night over dinner to the sound of swelling violins. I don't recall ever hearing her say it. But it was clear that Mum was operating via negative example. In the airline industry, they call it tombstone technology, the mechanical and operational improvements that follow a major plane crash. That was Mum's parenting model, more or less. Survey the wreckage and vow to do better. As grandchildren, safely buffered by a layer of management, we did not know exactly what it was like to be raised by Annie Slorence, but we knew enough about our grandmother to shudder at the idea. You didn't really communicate with Grandma. She communicated with you, and you dealt with it. There was nothing you could give her. Your opinions? Maybe a little advice about recent trends? No. You might as well offer $5 to a raccoon. Understanding Grandma was no simple task either. Like learning a language, it was a skill best acquired through early immersion. Mum was the expert. She was our resident Kremlinologist, interpreting for us the mysteries of a strange and frightening regime. Frequently, during Grandma's visits, I would overhear a seemingly innocuous exchange that would leave a mysterious chill in the air. It was then necessary to ask Mum to interpret what had just happened. Only she had the internal decoder. It might start with a remark from Dad. "We need new tires for the station wagon." To which Mum might reply, "Seems like we just bought the old ones." Which might then cause Grandma's jaw to clamp like a bear trap and an icy silence to descend. Later, Mum would explain. The issue of tire wear reminded Grandma that the family had left town to drive out east the previous summer instead of staying home and inviting her to visit. "Ah," we would say. The first word out of Grandma's mouth was usually, "No." She said it reflexively, like someone else would say "well" or to buy time while formulating an answer. If you said, for example, "They say it could rain today," Grandma might respond with, "No, it might rain in the afternoon." That initial "no" was instinctive. It was what she did best. And if upon reflection she found herself forced to agree with something, she would then adjust the sentence as best she could. After Grandpa died, we got plenty of Christmas visits from Grandma. It was no accident that her son Stan had moved to the New Jersey coast, almost as far from Grandma as was possible to be, without needing webbed feet. Margaret was in Ottawa, and not putting out the welcome mat. We, however, lived right across the prairies. Spending Christmas Eve with Grandma was always going to be a bit like watching Genghis Khan come down the chimney. But there was another aspect to her holiday visits that tended to interfere with the holiday spirit. It was Grandma's tortured relationship with gifts, both given and received. Grandma's philosophy was a sort of twisted tribute to the aphorism, "It's the thought that counts." Your thought would be interpreted by Grandma, and the evaluation would be based on both promptness and resale value. Grandma had her own return policy. If a gift mailed to her did not arrive before her birthday or Christmas, she would send it back. If you cared enough, you would take the trouble to get it there on time. Even more fraught with import was Grandma's own generosity. She would sometimes slip us kids $5 bills, a fortune at a time when we were getting 25-cent allowances. But they always came with conditions. Even then, I think we understood that each five was intended to buy us off. Seen in that light, the sum of $5 took on an insulting significance. A particularly telling gift was the golf cart. My eldest brother Joe played golf. Grandma decided to show her encouragement of this character-building behavior with a lavish gift, a two-wheeled bag cart. The gift was sent ahead by special delivery to be secretly wrapped for Christmas Eve. But the plan went awry. When the box arrived, it was Joe who answered the door. The surprise was ruined. Mum knew the situation held the potential for disaster. "When you open it," Mum instructed Joe, "you really, really have to act surprised." Christmas Eve came, and Joe opened the box. He gave it his best. "A golf cart!" he enthused. "Wow! Thank you, Grandma!" From her chair across the room, Grandma watched the performance. Her eyes narrowed. her jaw clenched, her lower lip pushed out.
Oh, you knew all along! Oh, I wish I'd never bought it!
Perhaps the greatest of Grandma's mysteries was her love map. Who did Grandma love? More tellingly, who did she dislike, and why? Not many people were as kind and considerate to Grandma as my father. He listened to her. He was respectful. He was kind. Grandma despised him. Bill Burgess had married her daughter, and some crimes can never be forgiven. My oldest brother Joe, born in 1952, would get more of the same. Grandma never warmed to him. The next two kids would fare somewhat better. But enough was enough. At Christmas 1956, my sister Leslie was showing as just a 3-month bulge. My grandparents pulled into the driveway. Grandma opened the car door and looked across the yard to where my mother stood waving in the doorway.
Oh, Grandma spat out, not again!
Grandma didn't love many people, but those she loved like a spider loves flies. Of the five kids, her favorite was number 3, my brother John, commonly known as Jock.
Steve, she once explained, I love all you kids equally, but Jock is special.
One day I was sitting in the living room reading when Grandma emerged from her bedroom after an afternoon nap. Catching sight of me, she smiled and began shuffling over. I had plenty of time to wonder what was up. Reaching me, she leaned over and offered her cheek. I planted a dutiful kiss, and she turned to gaze upon me with a blissful smile. Her eyes went wide.
You're not Jock, she cried. Oh, I thought you were a Jock.
And she tottered away, muttering. In my memory, she was wiping her cheek as she went, but that may be a bit of mental embellishment. As usual, the reasons for Grandma's preference were a mystery. It may simply have been that Jock was named and nicknamed after her husband. Jock always doted on Grandma and listened to her with patience and respect, but then so did my father, and Grandma hated him. So who knows? She also liked Lynn because, in a rare bit of insight, Grandma recognized her willful nature.
You're a little minx, she'd tell Lynn. You're like me.
Later in life, this declaration might have hung over Lynn like an oracle's dark prophecy. Eventually, George Lucas would come along to explain about the Force and how some go to the dark side, whereas others use it for good, which must have been a comfort. When we were very young, Grandma's favoritism stung. But once the kids got old enough to stop caring, we unloved ones quickly realized our good fortune. Being the object of Grandma's affection meant being snared in her sticky tendrils, subjected to endless, repetitive, solipsistic rambles mixed with stern advice and brandy-fueled aphorisms.
Life is like a game of golf, she'd say. You've got to keep trying.
Certain of Grandma's antics inspired only amusement. As she aged, Grandma became increasingly fond of brandy, a fact that she was intent on concealing. Her method was to stash brandy bottles in the bedroom closet. She would then go to the kitchen and pour a wholesome glass of ginger ale. A fine plan. Unfortunately, Grandma played it badly.
It's only ginger ale,
she would proclaim loudly, startling those of us who would otherwise be reading or watching TV.
I am just going to my bedroom with a glass of ginger ale.
I laughed, and my laughter was not the affectionate kind. I did not see my grandmother as a benign old coot. She was, to me, a malevolent force. Even when not in the house, she could and did make my mother cry. My mother would stand silently in the hall, holding the telephone while Grandma detailed some perceived slight or sign of filial ingratitude. By the time Mum finally hung up, there would sometimes be tears in her eyes. I was glad Grandma didn't choose me as one of her pets. It allowed me the luxury of anger and indifference. Having a kindly grandmother is a wonderful thing, but it's hardly essential. It is not your grandparents who have the power to shape your destiny, to make your home a nurturing, supportive environment or a battlefield of wills. That would be your parents. The old woman, who is just a seasonal annoyance to my siblings and me, was the primary caregiver to my mother. My mother was raised by a woman with a mind like a windowless room, a woman apparently incapable of empathy or self-analysis. Young Joan would barely make it through that upbringing.